Kinds of the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But this evening, we have as our special guest, and I'll ask you not to call in unless we specifically ask for questions. Our special guest is Lieutenant Colonel Daniel Marvin, who served in the Special Forces during the Vietnam era, had some amazing and harrowing experiences there. Eventually, he wrote a book about what he'd lived through during that era. And it took him, I don't know, 10, 12, well, he'll tell you how many years to get the book published. And there are people who do not want the American people to really know what happened in Vietnam. And we see this story told over and over again. Certainly, Monica Jensen Stevenson had written a book called Kiss the Boys Goodbye. It was a story of Vietnam. It was a story of the men we abandoned there. And her publisher actually pulled her book off the shelves of bookstores across America and wouldn't circulate the book. Monica got the rights to the book back, moved up to Canada, and there she got another publisher. They published the book. Somebody came in and immediately bought up the publisher and then just accidentally shredded 5,000 copies of Kiss the Boys Goodbye. Monica's second book, Sprite House, this was a story of Bobby Garwood, the soldier who was imprisoned, and of course when he came home, the government went out to make his life miserable and to say he was a traitor. Of course, he knew how many men were there. They didn't want him going around talking about all the men we abandoned, and so she got sued by something minor in the book, and what they wanted was all those books pulled off the shelves. This is how it's really done. We saw this with Carol Quigley's book, Tragedy and Hope, A History of the World at Our Time, written in 1966, where we talked about the secret society that really controls our government today. And, of course, somebody came in, bought up Macmillan Publishers, destroyed the place to the first half of the book. We have an interview with Professor Quigley where he tells the story. We actually have interviews with Monica Jensen Stevenson, where she tells us some of the stories about what happened to her book. And there's a wonderful book we carry into the buzzsaw. I think there are 18 authors by various people who tried to get the truth out and what happened to them. One of the authors who has an essay there, Gary Webb, because he, of course, told the truth about the CIA and drugs, died after committing suicide by shooting himself in the head twice. He shot himself in the head twice. Could that really happen in America? Well, there is an organized effort to suppress information, and with us is Lieutenant Colonel Daniel Marvin. And fortunately, when they brought a lawsuit against him, and they did bring a lawsuit against him and his publisher to try to silence them, they demanded they pull the book, stop publishing it, that they took it to court, and of course, fortunately, it took 2 hours for the jury to find that Daniel Marvin, Colonel Marvin, and the publisher were not guilty of libel at all. Colonel, thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, it's a blessing, as usual, to be on your program, Dr. Stan.
And, you know, of course, so would they have dropped the suit if you had just simply pulled the book?
Well, what they wanted us to do was not only pull the book or republish it as fantasy, but also they demanded that I write a letter to the world saying that the book was a lie.
All right, fine. We'll be back in just a moment. Well, our guest this evening is Colonel Daniel Marvin, and so we're talking about his book, The Expendable Elite. And Colonel, of course, you wouldn't write, wouldn't lie and tell them it was a lie. So then what happened?
Well, we went to court in Charleston, South Carolina. The court battle actually started on the 31st day of October and lasted for just 2 days at that time because all of a sudden the lead attorney for the plaintiffs disappeared. And they found him, they tell us, in the local hospital with some heart problems. And the judge reconvened the court on January the 23rd, and we presented our evidence. And what was one of the most interesting things is they try to use fear before the trial to get you not to show up. And, of course, we did show up. I think we're the only ones that ever have taken them to court. They took us to court, but to actually take part in the trial. And we presented all kinds of documentary evidence, to include audio tapes that the plaintiffs themselves had prepared and sent to me back in 1988, that not only corroborated what I had in the manuscript that I'd sent them, but provided me additional details that went in the book and were there presented to the judge and jury. And the plaintiffs had not one item of documentary evidence to prove that there was anything of a lie nature in the book.
Well, now, were you able to actually, under oath, ask any of the gentlemen who were testifying against you, many of them had been with you, how they were threatened and how they were forced to perjure themselves? Because actually it was a case of perjury, and the government knew it was perjury. At least the Special Forces Organization, which worked with the CIA, understood what was going on.
Well, I didn't have an opportunity to ask them under oath, no. But I did tell the jury this, that neither Chris nor I, Chris is the publisher, Chris Milligan, wanted anything bad to happen to the plaintiffs. We didn't want their money or anything, because those were brave men. I mean, anybody who reads the book, Expendable Elite, knows that those men who were there in court trying to ruin me and ruin my publisher so there'd be no more books published by Trinday were there because they had been coerced, or I can't figure any other way.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Colonel Marvin is simply pointing out that he was told, well, if you just pull the book off the market and write a letter and say that it's all fiction, none of it's true, then, of course, you won't get sued. Would they have dropped the suit if you'd put the letter out saying it was all a lie?
Oh, yes.
And so, basically, this is what they did. And then, apparently, Colonel Marvin had actually tried to talk to the people, you know, the men who'd been with him. And they were actually threatened and actually told they'd lose their pensions. They were forced to give perjured testimony by people within, who knows who was behind it, but the Special Forces Association, the CIA, somebody put up a great deal of money to silence Colonel Marvin and to prevent the information getting to the American people, because the last thing they want the American people to know is that one of course, Colonel Marvin's assignments was to kill the Crown Prince of Cambodia. Of course, he didn't do it because he'd let them know that he wanted something in return if he was going to risk his life and his men's life to carry out this this dishonest, illegal project. But that's the sort of thing that the CIA was doing, and they used the Special Forces sometimes. Didn't they use them as assassins?
Well, we were trained that during our training session at Fort Bragg in the spring of 1964, just shortly after President Kennedy was assassinated, we were told by CIA instructors that the CIA would use Special Forces for assassinations outside of the United States, and they would use Mafia personnel for assassinations inside the United States. In fact, they pretty well laid it out that there were four Mafia hitmen involved in the Kennedy assassination. Two of them were American Mafia. In fact, one of them was Jimmy Files, who's in Joliet Prison right now. I correspond with him regularly. He was part of the Mafia working for the CIA, and he was the man who stood on the grassy knoll behind that fence and shot the president and killed him. And there is a documentary film coming out on that that Wim Dankbar is doing.
Well, now, of course, when you were at the School for Assassins, why weren't you basically told that at least the inference was that the CIA had been involved and that killed Kennedy because, of course, he was a traitor to the country, something like that?
That's correct. Yep. They must have cooked up some kind of thing. But now, they didn't come right out and tell us point blank that they had run the operation, but they explained the whole operation to include the fact there was one mafia man on the grassy knoll, there was one on the rooftop next to the Texas Book Depository, and there were two other mafia personnel from France that were on the two routes leading from where Kennedy was hit to the hospital, and they were there with spotters with high-powered binoculars, so that if Kennedy made it that far and they looked like he'd make it once he got to the hospital, then they'd shoot him again.
And for our listeners out there who would, of course, want to challenge this sort of thing, we have a book written by the brother of the head of the CIA at that time. The author was Chuck Giancana, and, of course, he was the brother of Sam Giancana, who was the headed of the mafia in one of the major cities at that time. And Chuck Giancana tells, you know, how the mafia was carrying out the hits for the CIA and how they were responsible for, or at least involved, with the Kennedy assassination. Now, I don't know whether Sam Giancana or some other parts of the mafia, but I know Colonel Marvin has actually talked to other people associated with the mafia who had been approached by the CIA to be involved in murdering the president.
That's right. Master Sergeant Joseph Hill and myself in the spring of 1964 met with the head of the Boston area mafia who owned a big construction company. In fact, he offered Joe Hill and I a job as a hit team. Because he knew that we were trained as assassins. I asked him point blank, were you asked to be a part of the Kennedy hit? And he said, yes, the company called me. And he said, these are almost his exact words, I told him that we don't have no problems with the Kennedys in Massachusetts, and he didn't get involved in it.
And I think
he
a lot
had
of them
been called and asked to get the president in Massachusetts.
And I think, of course, a lot of the mafia didn't want to have anything to do with this because they didn't want to take a chance on bringing the wrath of the American people down on them. But they were able to find some people to do that. The CIA was definitely involved. They were involved in the murder. They were involved with the cover-up. And, of course, so were high officials in the FBI. And when you realize this sort of thing can really happen, who else can they kill? What other atrocities are they behind? There is a dark force within our society, and Colonel Marvin can certainly attest to that, and he's come under tremendous pressure because he's tried to tell the American people the truth. And he's tried because, of course, he became a born-again Christian later in life. And,
amen.
And that really has given him the impetus to try to get the truth out about what happened. Well, anyways, let's get back to the trial, because certainly this must have been a terrible or an expensive ordeal for you and your family. And one of the reasons we asked Colonel Marvin to come on is certainly my wife and I have contributed to his the fund. They owe probably, well, what, over $100,000?
Over $100,000, yes. You were very generous, and I really appreciate what you and your wife did for us.
Well, if anybody out there in the listening audience would like to help to pay off, because basically this is how they silence people in America. They've run them into courts. They've got unlimited funds. They've got CIA funds behind them, and the CIA's got all the money in the world. All the money that, you know, and they can, of course, go after anybody and drag them into court and then bankrupt them this way. Could this happen in a free society? How could people contribute to your fund if they'd like to?
Well, I really appreciate you mentioning that. They can call Chris Milligan at Trinday Press at 1-800-556-2012.
One more time. Give that number again, please, Colonel.
800-556-2012. And just tell them that you'd like to contribute to the Legal Defense Fund. And it is important, because what they tried to do was to break us financially. And if it wasn't for two courageous attorneys who were willing to take the money on a monthly basis if necessary, and I don't know if I'll live long enough to pay it off, on a monthly basis. But because they knew that we were right. They knew that book was important for this world. In fact, when I first got the lawsuit, and I think your listeners will be interested in this, it was in June of 2004, and I noticed that it was signed by Raymond Johnson. And Raymond Johnson and I were very close friends. And we were just planning at that very time for he and Marlene, who is his wife, and Kate, my wife, and I were going to meet in Worcester, Massachusetts, and the Gank Cars home up there. That's where Ray Johnson is from. And then I see his name on there, so I called Ray. And I said, Ray, I'm hurt. I just saw your name on this lawsuit for $100,000 against me. Each one of the seven people wanted $100,000. And I said, I'm hurt. And he says, I'm hurt too, Dai-Wee. And I said, well, why'd you do it? And he says, they called me and told me to come down there and sign it, and I signed it, and I can't talk about it. So that's the kind of stuff they use, strong-arm tactics.
And, of course, this is the great tragedy, ladies and gentlemen. This is the sort of thing that goes on in America to silence good people. And most of the men in the special forces are true patriots. They believe they're fighting for their country. They do not realize that there are dark forces, very evil forces, that are working at the highest levels of our government. And they're committing all sorts of atrocities throughout the world. They're killing international leaders. They kill world leaders and put people in who won't go along with the agenda. If you don't believe that, you need to read John Perkins' a great book, Confessions of an Economic Hitman. That's Confessions of an Economic Hitman. And we have so much other information. Well, you go back in the Church Committee hearings back in the 1970s. Senator Church held hearings, and they got the information that the CIA had killed Patrice Lumumba. That killed the president of Dominican Republic, Trujillo, that killed Diem and Nguyen, and of course in Vietnam. They were the rulers of Vietnam. They simply kill people, and they hire professional hitmen to do that. This is your tax money at work. And this is not accountable to government, and there's so much going on today that is not accountable to our elected representatives. There is a dark force out there. Well, anyway, now, is the case pretty well over? Can they appeal the verdict on that?
They have until midnight tonight.
All right.
To appeal it. Once that time is over with, they cannot appeal. You also handle the book Barry and the Boys, don't you?
Right, we certainly do.
Now, there's a book that author is being sued also, Daniel Hopsicker. And that's a book that tells the truth about the biggest drug-running operation in the world, and it's the CIA. In fact, when I fought for 13 years to try and find a publisher, and the CIA has all these publishers so afraid, even Presidio. And E.J. McCarthy, who is the head of the Presidio team, called me two or three times and said they wanted to publish a book very much, but I'd have to take the CIA out of it before they'd publish it. And he finally wrote me a letter at my request, and in that he said they couldn't publish it because of the spooky nature of it.
Well,
we call the CIA spooks.
Well, our good friend Craig Roberts wrote a wonderful book. He'd actually had about 10 books published, and he wrote a book going into the background of the Kennedy assassination, so many other things. He had his agent take it around to major publishers in New York who'd published his other books, and none of them would touch the book. And later he got a call from one of the senior editors at Simon & Schuster saying what a great book it was, and he had to get it published. And Craig said, well, you know, if it's a great book, why wouldn't you publish it? And the man said, I'd lose my job. Don't you know the CIA has men planted with all the major publishing houses?
Amen.
To suppress things like that. If I published your book, I'd be out of a job tomorrow.
So I went to 120 publishers.
And that's how things, that's what they call freedom of the press in America today. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, and we're simply talking about what goes on as far as publishing. There's a wonderful book. It's written by Lieutenant General William Odom, who for many years was in charge of the National Security Agency. He came out with a book, I think it was in 2003, called Fixing Intelligence. And, of course, because he was certainly a high-ranking official in the intelligence agencies, I'm sure he'd signed all sorts of pledges and promises and contracts that he would not reveal what he knew. So what he did was ask questions in the book, like, should the Central Intelligence Agency have agents planted in the media? Should the Army be kept collecting dossiers on American citizens? Should the CIA be assassinating people? He just asked the questions. He didn't say they were doing it. But I think if you read between the lines, well, you'll know exactly what he's telling you. The CIA has people planted within the journalistic system and in our publishing industry and at every level of our society in total violation of our laws. But then, who's going to go after the CIA? And, of course, this goes over. We have 14 intelligence agencies in America. They all work in concert, and now they're telling us the CIA is being phased out a little bit. But the intelligence, now they're expanding the power of the military intelligence. There are
right.
14 intelligence agencies. I bet there's now 1 in 1,000 Americans who realizes that. That was all, of course, the original Joint Senate Intelligence Committee. If you'd like the documentation on it, we'll get it to you. Give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. But it's important that you out there in the listening audience really understand what's going on today. And then help us get the truth out across America. Well, Colonel, as of midnight tonight, then, this case dies?
That's right. It was interesting that in the court because, and actually we were in court a total of 7 days, 5 days the last time. But to have the jury actually be there, sit there and listen to the audio tapes that John Strait and Ray Johnson and Sirois had done in 1988 to help me with the book, and then to see a letter signed by the Secretary of the Special Forces Association in 1990 wishing me the greatest success in the book after he'd read part of the manuscript. And then to hear the same people come up and say that was all lies that they told. So the jury just could tell which was the truth. In fact, one of the plaintiffs was drunk when he was up there on the stand. They'd just been forced to testify, to lie, to perjure themselves. Unfortunately, we don't have the money to go after the Special Forces Association as we stand right now. Of course, we always could in the future. But they've got us down to the point right now where we're just trying very hard to pay our bills.
Well, of course, this is how they do it. And this is the sort of thing that they do in America today to silence people who are trying to tell the American people the truth. And so, we need to stand behind Colonel Marvin. We need to stand behind others who are in the same thing. I know Daniel Hopsiger, who's written some great investigative reporting. And, of course, his book, Barry and the Boys, goes into the CIA involvement with drug smuggling. And the CIA is involved in drug smuggling. We have a great 4-tape set on that, and you'll actually hear Colonel, pardon me, Bill Clinton, when asked about CIA drug smuggling and Mena Airport, he said, "Oh, that was a government operation." Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and our guest is Colonel Daniel Marvin, and we were talking about the CIA and the involvement in the drug smuggling, and of course, Daniel Hopsiger wrote a book about it. He's getting sued. On what basis are they suing Daniel Hopsiger? Do you know, Colonel?
I do not know that. You'd have to ask him or Chris. He was down there at our trial for a couple of days, too.
Right, and of course we do know that Gary Webb had written a book and a number of newspaper articles about... Gary Webb was a Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter for the San Jose Mercury. First of all, the CIA put pressure on newspapers all across the country not to hire Gary Webb. He couldn't get a job anywhere. I mean, one of the finest investigative reporters in the country, but of course nobody would dare hire him because the CIA threatened, I'm sure, in one way or another threatened him. And then Gary Webb ended up committing suicide by shooting himself in the head twice. I wonder how many people really think that, you're going to shoot yourself in the head twice to be sure you're dead. Well, this is the sort of thing goes on, not imaginary. This is not something comes out of Hollywood. This is the sort of thing I deal with. A number of the people I've interviewed through the years have died under very mysterious circumstances. I've talked to at least three people who were government assassins. This does happen. It's the real world.
William Bruce Pitcher, he died, and they set it all up as a suicide, and yet I was asked myself to kill him the first week of August in 1965.
Why don't you tell that story? I think it's worthwhile repeating.
Well, Colonel Patton, C.W. Patton, who was the commanding officer of the 6th Special Forces Group at Fort Bragg, and he called me up to his office. He also called a Captain David V. Vanek up there, and he told us individually to go meet a company man in the pine trees behind the headquarters. A company, of course, the CIA man. And we headed down there, and I went first, and Vanek was about 40 feet behind me, and the CIA man asked if I would like to assassinate a man who was about to give state secrets to the enemy. Well, it's, by the way, it's always a request. They cannot order you to terrorize or to kill or to do any of that kind of thing. They have to ask you to do it. It's all volunteer. And, of course, there's no paperwork. No, they're protected 100%. And I said, certainly, somebody giving state secrets to the enemy. And I asked who it was, and he said, Lieutenant Commander William Bruce Pitcher. And I said, then where is he at? As I was on orders to go to Vietnam, and the way that it would work normally is I would go to Vietnam, and then I'd go whatever country this man would be in and take care of him and be dropped from the rolls as a deserter while I'm gone and then be picked back up when I came back. And he said, well, he's in Bethesda Naval Hospital. And I refused it right then and there. I said, look, I got a wife and 3 children right here at Fort Bragg, North Carolina. I can't disappear today. They'll wonder where the heck I'm at. You're supposed to use mafia for stateside hits. Well, anyway, I refused it. In October 1966, he was found dead in his office underneath the stepladder, and I believe that stepladder was he was using to go up. He was about to leave the Navy to retire, and he was the actual man who photographed the autopsy of John F. Kennedy. And Dennis David, a friend of mine, was there, stood next to William Bruce Pitcher when he was alive, and saw those same photographs of the true autopsy of John F. Kennedy. And he and I have offered through congressmen and senators, and you know this, Dr. Stan, to go before Congress and testify to the truth of the Pitcher assassination and the real truth about the Kennedy assassination, and none of them have got guts enough to call us.
And, of course, for anybody who would like to check that out, we actually have an interview in our 4-tape set on the Kennedy assassination with Dr. Crenshaw, who was a surgical resident at the Parkland Hospital in Dallas, Texas, on the day that President Kennedy was shot and brought to the hospital. And, of course, the wounds that he saw were entirely different than what you've been told. He was at that time then ordered not to reveal what he'd seen, or he'd never practiced medicine.
Amen.
He eventually became chief of surgery at a major hospital, and 20 or 25 years later he wrote a book. And he was immediately, of course, libeled, insulted, attacked by the Journal of Medical Association, and so he sued them. And they gave him $250,000, you know, saying, well, of course, we could win the case. We know that Dr. Crenshaw is lying, but after all, it's cheaper just to give him the $25,000 than to take it to court. And this is what they do. But we have that interview. Dr. Crenshaw has since gone, you know, to his great reward. I don't know whether he died a natural death or not. We have the interview. It's available. It's in the Kennedy assassination 4-tape set. And an entirely different story than you're going to hear elsewhere.
Well, Dr. Stan...
Hold on. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, and our guest this evening is Lieutenant Colonel Daniel Marvin. Go ahead, Colonel.
Well, what I was going to say is that people should be concerned, your listeners, about the direction this country is going in, I honestly believe that since President Kennedy was assassinated, that no president has really run the country all by himself. It's been a kind of a committee. And you have, in your storehouse of interviews and tapes and books, the true story about what is wrong in this great country of ours. And we were a great country. And the people out there should write or call you and get an index of what you have, and then get what they'd be interested in. And then they can all help by writing congressmen and senators and demanding some action before all of us who are willing to come forward are dead. I'm 72 years old, and I hope to live another 20 years, but I'd like to go to Congress tomorrow.
Well, I'm afraid that most of our congressmen, they have something on all of them, and if they don't, they'll make it up. I mean, if they,
that's right.
I'm sure they did this with Congressman, I think it was George Hanson, and they trumped up charges on him, and they sent him to prison. He was tortured. Here's a congressman, but they actually sent him to prison. He was tortured and mistreated for 10 years, and after 10 years, they said, oh, shucks, George, we found out that the law that we were prosecuted under was, of course, illegal, but that's too bad. And they let him out of prison. But you see, that is, of course, how they terrorize the other congressmen.
That's right. And
most of them back there realize, of course, they can go after them. You don't have to commit a crime. They'll make up a crime. It's the way they got a John DeLorean. You remember the John DeLorean? Basically, what had happened was that Margaret Thatcher was very unhappy because John DeLorean had a motor plant in Ireland, and he was paying good salary. And a lot of that money that was going to his workers was ending up with the IRA, and they wanted to cut off the funds, so they had to destroy DeLorean. So they blocked him from getting money anyplace, borrowing money to run his factory. And then they planted a man in his neighborhood for years, posed as his friend. John DeLorean thought this man was his friend. He was a government informant who set him up on a sting operation, supposedly to be taking drug money. Wasn't the case at all. But, of course, there was no crime committed. The government wanted to get DeLorean so that they... they set him up illegally. You have to be afraid, ladies and gentlemen, of your best friend, because he could be an FBI informant. DeLorean got off because the truth actually came out at the trial, but the average American has never heard the true story. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Our guest is Lieutenant Colonel Daniel Marvin, and if you're out there in the listening audience would like to talk to Colonel Marvin, give us a call at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or 464-8295. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. And of course, when Colonel Marvin was in Vietnam, they were operating there right along the Cambodian border. Special forces teams are very, very unusual people. They're very highly trained, very intelligent, very capable people, and they operate in groups of 10 to 20.
12 is the normal team size. 12 Green Berets.
Okay, and of course they go in. They certainly are law unto themselves. They can do what they think is right. But they recruit only the best of people. In fact, most people who try out for the special forces don't make it, do they, Colonel?
That's correct. In fact, when I went through, I believe only a third of the officers who went in made it through the course. And normally, officers don't flunk any course. But enlisted men, only 5 out of 100 in 1964 made the grade, believe it or not. 5 out of 100. They're the best troops. And one of the big problem is the brainwashing to get them to do anything legal or illegal for the flag. And it's a shame, because they don't purposely, I believe, want to get involved in anything illegal. But the pressures on you are really something. When I was fighting to free General Quang Van Dang from the tentacles of the CIA in 1991, Congressman Matthew McHugh had his senior staffer, this will be in Bruce Leitchek's book, by the way, The Devious Elite, Jean McPheeters was her name, called a member of my family on the telephone in Ithaca, New York, and said, "You can tell Colonel Marvin that he may not be afraid of anybody but Jesus Christ, but remind him he's got grandchildren."
In other words, they were threatening you if you came forward with the truth.
That's right. Now, can you imagine what that did to my family? It was just last year, really, in 2005, that finally can get to the point where all of my family, you know, welcomes me into the fold, more or less. Because here I was, an enemy of the CIA, you know, or one of their targets.
Well, we've heard this sort of story time and time again. In fact, there was a lawsuit that was carried out by a gentleman who was trying to find out, of course, what had happened to his brother, who was one of the prisoners of war that our government abandoned and over there. And of course, they put together an excellent DVD by Bill Dumas, put it together. We actually have that, and it goes into the background of the men who were abandoned there. But one of the when they're taking this case to court, this is about 1980. And remember, they abandoned these boys in 1953 or 54. And some of the men who'd been in the prisoner of war camps with Bill Dumas' uncle, you know, were going to testify at this trial that he had been a prisoner of war. Well, the last thing the government wants is for the American people, and certainly the young men, the idealistic men who may want to go off and fight in our war, is to find out that an official government policy is to abandon them, and they've abandoned thousands and thousands and tens of thousands of American soldiers to die, left them, abandoned them totally. So, of course, in Korea, there are about 8,000 men that we betrayed and left behind, young men who went overseas to fight for their country. Well, this trial is coming up in the early 80s, and there are five men who had been in the prison camp and they were all visited by high government officials and threatened if they were going to go and testify. And they were still going to go. Two of them suddenly died, and two others became violently ill. And so only one man is able to come to testify at this trial in Washington, D.C. And just before he goes in to testify, he's been flown in by the families to give testimony. Why, of course, he's visited by a high-ranking official who says, if you testify, we'll bring out some facts about your mother and an illicit extramarital affair she had. And this man says, my mother's long since dead. Why are you doing this? And, well, if you don't do what's right, we're going to bring this information out. Ladies and gentlemen, there are evil and wicked people out there. And Bill Dumas tells that story, and we have the interviews with him if you'd like to see it. We also carry his excellent DVD on the story of the prisoners that were abandoned in Korea, just as we abandoned them in Vietnam. And unfortunately, ladies and gentlemen, there are evil forces in our government, and they know exactly what they're doing. They just want the American people to know. There are a lot of good people. Most of the people in the military are patriotic. They love this country. Most people in special forces are patriotic.
That's right.
But they do not understand the dark forces that are at work here as well.
Can we get into the General Westmoreland thing?
You get right into that, Colonel.
Okay, because one of the main reasons why we were taken to court is in my book, Expendable Elite. I actually quote General Westmoreland from his book, A Soldier Reports, where he admits that he was not only aware that the enemy had safe haven sanctuaries inside of Cambodia, and that the enemy used the Mekong River, which we protected the foreign ships taking weapons and ammunition to the enemy in their safe havens in Cambodia so they could turn around and kill our people. He admits that in his book, and nobody seemed to pay attention, so I brought it out in my book hard and heavy, because probably 80% of the men in Vietnam were killed because General Westmoreland didn't have guts enough to tell Congress. In fact, to stop the sanctuaries, he admits in the book that he was ordered not to tell Congress that the enemy had sanctuaries. He was ordered not to tell the press. Well, I brought that all out, and this is the reason they picked Charleston, South Carolina, as the place for the trial, because Charleston is the home of the Citadel, Citadel is the last organization that General Westmoreland ran as a chief executive officer, and it is also the memorial highway around Charleston. One of the highways is the General William C. Westmoreland Highway. But we brought that out in court, and the jury had guts enough and had integrity enough so that they understood what was the truth about General Westmoreland.
Well, I think that tragically there were so many of the military men who did not have the courage to stand up and say what's going on is wrong. Now, that is true today. And, of course, Congressman John Murtha is speaking out against what's happening in Iraq today. He's, a highly decorated Vietnam veteran and retired as a Marine Corps colonel and has always been pro-military until, of course, he realized what's going on in Iraq. And I saw him recently interviewed by Mike Wallace, who said, well, the generals there, they think this is a great war and we're doing great. And Congressman Murtha said, that's not what they tell me in private. So the generals have gone to Congressman Murtha and tried to get him to do something to stop this war. And the same thing is true with General Zinni, a four-star Marine Corps general. And he talks about how the generals do not want this war. A recent Zogby poll showed that I think it was 72% of the enlisted men over there that were surveyed, and they surveyed close to 1,000. Unless, of course, they were there for their third and volunteered to go back. But for the regular people who are over there, 72% wanted to get out as soon as they could. They thought it's futile, the whole thing was wrong. But you see, the average general cannot speak out today, and they couldn't speak out in Vietnam. And that's tragic thing you have to do is you have to be willing to resign, to give up your commission, to give up your power, to give up everything to do what's right. And we need more men who will do that.
Amen. You know, even to the extent when a general is retired, I think I told you about Sean O'Connell, who listened to my lecture up in the Worcester, Massachusetts area, and when I told about me calling one of my men to try and reach him and his wife answering the phone and saying, I can't let you talk to John, Dan, because we'll lose our retirement pay if he talks to you. And I told that at the lecture, and he went home and told his father, who's a retired full colonel, and his uncle, who's a retired brigadier general, and the general told him, you tell Colonel Marvin that I'll write a letter that he can send to those men that proves they cannot lose their retirement pay. I waited 2 months, never got that letter. And what happened is, I called Sean O'Connell, his nephew, and he called the general, Brigadier General.
Oh, well, I'll put the name out here. I don't want to get myself sued.
Oh.
Go ahead.
Oh.
He called the general, and what happened?
Right. And the general said that, and the Brigadier General said that there was two of the meanest CIA men right in his area, and he didn't want to even talk to Dan Marvin anymore.
And, of course, the thing is that the CIA will go after people. They're not supposed to operate here in America, ladies and gentlemen, but they do. They violate the laws. They're a law unto themselves. And how could that be? I mean, what about our elected representatives? Aren't we a nation of laws? No. We're a nation of secret societies and powerful forces that have a different agenda. And, of course, their dedication is not to America, but to this idea of a one-world order and a one-world religion. And this is what's behind so much of what's going on today, the globalization, the loss of our jobs, the loss of our factories, failure to close our borders, and, of course, the attack on Christianity. When you see that and understand that this is organized, the Supreme Court decisions were orchestrated to take God out of our schools.
Yes.
How could that possibly be when the Supreme Court opens its sessions every day? As the crier comes in before the United States Supreme Court and says, God save the United States and this honorable court. What they should say is, God save the United States and, condemn this dishonorable court. But, of course, they don't say that. How can they open their sessions talking about God and they won't allow mention of God in our schools? Well,
simply,
there's an organized effort to destroy Christianity. When you understand that, everything makes sense. If you don't understand that, nothing makes sense.
That's correct. Well, you have done so much in your radio program to help the people of this nation understand what they should be interested in and what they should be doing to try and elect people who we can trust. and then force those people to behave once they're in.
Amen to that. And of course, when they get to Congress, as congressmen, they keep them so busy. You don't really think they read the laws that they vote on to you. They rely upon somebody who comes in and tells them how to vote. And that's why we have to be there to tell them what these bills say and to let them know that we're going to let everybody know how they vote. And that's
Amen.
One thing that the congressman fears, you know, that you're going to find out how he's voted. And he doesn't really even know what's in the bills he's voting on. In most instances, they don't have time to read them. They keep them so busy. It's all a facade to give you the idea that we have representative government. We have in Washington, D.C. today some of the finest legislators that money could buy. Our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. And you out there in the listening audience need to know what the legislation is and other organizations we can put you in touch with that we trust that can help you to advise your congressman. But if you'd like to talk to Colonel Marvin, who I think is a great hero, who had the courage to tell the truth about what happened and what he saw in Vietnam, and the fact that we were not really allowed to win the war. It was simply a great military exercise. In my estimation, it was a great distraction. As our young men went overseas to fight for freedom, we lost our freedom here at home. And that was the time during the Vietnam War when they suddenly found a woman had the right to abort her children, when they took God and prayer out of our schools, when they changed their immigration laws, when they began to centralize power in Washington, D.C. It was all about distraction. Keep the people's attention overseas. And if you don't believe that, a wonderful article written by McGeorge Bundy, Skull and Bones, Council on Foreign Relations, National Security Advisor who got us into the war. It's in January 1967. Foreign Affairs Magazine, the magazine read by the elite, who determined, of course, the course of our country. Well, Colonel, you know, at this point, are you going to then continue getting that book out and continue getting it circulated?
Well, actually, we got the new revised edition you will love of Expendable Elite because it will include the very beginning. There will be a, what's it called? Not a forward, but the...
The preface and the introduction.
Preface, right. Thank you very much. Preface by Douglas Valentine. He called me 2 days after our victory in court and asked me if he could write the preface to the new book because he wants his name to be used to help promote that book as something everybody should read. And he is the world's renowned expert on CIA assassination programs. And then we're going to have another chapter added to it, which we're working on as I speak, which will be about the lawsuit and about the trial, and we'll go into details of the individuals involved, the plaintiffs, and why they sued me and my publisher.
Well, of course, they will do anything to keep the American people from getting the truth. They actually, anybody who wants to understand the media, you have to understand that, you know, 95% of the major outlets in America are controlled by 5 mega corporations. That's covered in an excellent book called
The
New Media Monopoly. Yes, we do have some privately owned radio stations, such as the ones you're listening to us on tonight. Yes, we do have certainly a few, maybe a half a dozen newspapers in America that'll tell the truth, but so many of the major newspapers and all of the major magazines and all of the major television networks are all controlled by people who fit into this corporate group. There are 5 mega corporations. The book is The New Media Monopoly, written by a professor, Ben Bekdakian, at Berkeley. He's been studying this since 1983. Fascinating book. The New Media Monopoly, and of course Colonel Marvin's book, The Expendable Elite. And if you'd like to know more about them, our telephone number is 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. But The Expendable Elite is a fascinating story. It's a story of Colonel Marvin and what happened when he was in Cambodia, and of course what happened when he refused to kill or assassinate Prince Sihanouk, the Crown Prince of Cambodia. Would you like to just briefly touch on what happened there?
Yes. Well, when Walter McKim, CIA agent, came to my camp and met with Major Foy Van Lee, my counterpart, myself, and asked if we would put together a group to go into Cambodia and attack and kill Sihanouk when he's on the way on his regular annual trip to a certain temple. And I agreed to it. We had plenty of volunteers, over 100. We trained 42 of them. But I gave them a quid pro quo that President Johnson would have to eliminate the safe havens for the enemy and the actual use of the Mekong River before we would go into Cambodia.
And, of course, basically when the CIA, of course, would not do that, and then they sent a regiment, and they were going to kill Colonel Marvin and all of his men, and it was simply a fortunate act of God, an intervention by a friend that kept them all from being killed by our own government. Why? Because they wouldn't go along with the program.
Right.
We'll be right back. Well, Colonel, why don't you pick the story up there, because you know it a lot better than I
do. Okay. But the one thing that we did in court that really helped our country, I think, but hurt the CIA, is that we proved that it was true that there was an Arvin regiment that had been sent by the CIA to kill me and my men, Americans and Vietnamese, in our camp, An Phu, in South Vietnam, in June of 1966. And if it hadn't been for General Quang Van Dang, an American Colonel William Desabri, who was his senior advisor, who actually got in Colonel Desabri's chopper and flew over that regiment and turned it around, because that regiment had been sent by the CIA conversation with Premier Key, who was a close friend of theirs.
And what was that wonderful movie that we saw many years ago with Marlon Brando?
Apocalypse Now.
Apocalypse Now. And of course, there was a lot of truth to that story.
Oh, amen.
And that actually had happened. It not, exactly as it was portrayed, but there was
It was a very similar circumstance to mine. An A-team, Special Forces A-team, went into the Cao Mau Peninsula of Vietnam and worked with Father Wah, who was a Catholic priest, and they organized a Catholic CIDG group, same as we had Buddhist Hua House, and they cleared the Viet Cong out of their area in the Cao Mau Peninsula, and all of a sudden, like they ordered my team out of An Phu, they ordered his team out of the Cao Mau Peninsula, and all of his men left except him.
And why didn't he leave? He wanted to stay there.
He wanted to honor their commitment, which is the same reason my men all decided they wanted to stay and honor our commitment, and we all were there to go against that regiment, where he was left by himself, and two other Green Berets were sent in there and killed him.
And, ladies and gentlemen, this is what they do. I mean, if you don't go along with their agenda, if you're not quite willing to abandon those people who put their confidence in you, you'll get killed. We're talking about the real world, and I wish it weren't so. Everything were as we imagine it is, but there are dark and sinister spiritual forces at work behind the scenes. And today we see the quagmire they're in Iraq. How did we get there? Why, they sent a man named Paul Bremer over as presidential envoy. And when we could have reestablished an Iraqi government, Paul Bremer disbanded the Iraqi army, the Iraqi police force, the Iraqi civil service, and plunged the nation into chaos. And then, of course, every effort was made to block a reconstitution of the Iraqi army to maintain the chaos. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Colonel Marvin, we're just about out of time. I want to thank you so very much for being with us this evening. I know it's late back where you are, but do you have any parting thoughts for our listeners?
My parting thought is God bless you and the people that help you there at that station, and the fact that you bring good, honest people onto the air to tell the American people things that we need to know. Yeah. God bless you.
Well, thank you so very much. Let's get your telephone number up one more time if people would like to help you and Chris as far as those massive bills that they've run up against you.
We would really appreciate it. It's 800-556-2012.
Well, God bless you, and thank you for everything you do,
Colonel.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
God bless you. Bye-bye.
Well, this is Dr. Stan. I hope you've enjoyed our interview with Colonel Marvin. He's a very, very courageous man, and it's people like this who need our help. People are willing to come forward and tell the truth, and what we need are men of courage and integrity for times like this. But, ladies and gentlemen, this is the time when I have to remind our listeners that Radio Liberty is primarily listener-supported, and we depend upon those of you who listen to our programs to help us. Every week we reach out on about 60 outlets, and you know, some of our programs are heard on as many as 30 stations. This evening program is going to be heard on about 30 stations, either directly or rebroadcast. It's an expensive proposition, but we think it's worthwhile. Do you? I do think it's important that the American people understand that we're involved in a spiritual battle. It's being fought on a political and ideological and cultural battlefield, but it's a political battle. All the indications are that the government is planning, you know, unless there can be enough of an outcry from the American people to stop it, the government is planning to go into Iran and to attack Iran and to attack Syria and to expand the war and inflame the entire Muslim world. And you say, why would anybody want to do a thing like that? I mean, we're going to go in just to bomb Iran a little bit and knock out their nuclear capability. Ladies and gentlemen, if we do that, why, of course, Musharraf in Pakistan will probably be overthrown. Mubarak will probably be overthrown in Egypt. And we will have a third world war. And we will have the class of civilizations that Samuel Huntington warns about in his book, The Class of Civilizations. We'll have a horrible and bloody nuclear holocaust that will impact. And we're not talking about imaginary things. We're talking about the very real possibility of this happening. And when is it going to happen? Well, we're just going to have to see how things play out. But already we're talking about taking Iran to the United Nations because, of course, they're enriching uranium. And I would simply ask, well, certainly Pakistan has nuclear weapons to the south. And India and China to the east has had nuclear weapons, and they've threatened to nuke Los Angeles, and Russia to the north has nuclear weapons. Why are we so concerned about Iran? Certainly Venezuela and Brazil are both enriching uranium in preparation to getting their own nuclear weapons. Why are we so concerned about Iran? And I would like to suggest because the real agenda is to plunge us into World War III. You need to get my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, our pamphlets on the occult hierarchy, the new DVD, The Secret Mysteries of America's Beginning, our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. Please pray for America. Pray for revival. Please pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection. And so until we're together again, may the Lord be with you. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you, the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers. And, of course, we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Or here in the central coast of California at 464-8295. But please hold your calls for the time being, because we have with us on the line Arthur Bernclough from the Veterans for Constitutional Law. And Arthur, of course, is really an advocate for veterans. And what you don't understand is that there's, of course, all this, we've got to support our men. It's a patriotic thing to support our fighting men. But once they come home to this country, why, of course, they're just useless cattle. And, of course, many times the disability that they're entitled to, the medical care that they're entitled to, the concern and compassion they're entitled to is totally ignored because it costs money. And the politicians would far rather have it go to sources that would provide more votes for them. And, of course, there is a crass indifference on the part of many people in the Veterans Administration for caring for the veterans. In fact, there is a policy in certain divisions of the Veterans Administration to give bonuses to those who can deny the most benefits to the veterans. Could this really be happening in America? Well, ladies and gentlemen, we know that of the fighting men, there were 695,000 men in Gulf War I, in the first Gulf War, and somewhere between a third and a half of those came back and had Gulf War illness, and the government knew what it was. Of course, they know what it is. We have the government reports going into the fact that it's a very real entity, and yet, of course, they denied it and denied it and denied it. And now, of course, we find about a third of the young men who are coming back from this Gulf War, within 3 months they're ill. They call it post-traumatic stress, but is it really post-traumatic stress, or is it similar to the diseases that were created by the experimental vaccines that were used on our troops during the first Gulf War? Because they do experiment on our troops. If you've never seen read the book Vaccine A, which we do carry, or the 4-tape set we have on Vaccine A, and the experimental vaccines that were given to our boys, but they've experimented on our soldiers for years. Because, you see, as Henry Kissinger is quoted in saying in Woodward and Bernstein's book, The Final Days, the military is just stupid, dumb cattle to be used for foreign policy purposes. So that's the attitude, unfortunately, of some of the ruling elite. The military is nothing but stupid, dumb animals to be used for foreign policy purposes, so they experiment on them. And then they come back, and many of them are ill for the rest of their lives. Arthur, thank you so very much for being with us.
Dr. Stan, it's so good to be on with you again. We'll talk about this. I call it an American tragedy. It's the plight of the United States of War Wounded. And one of the terrible legacies, Dr. Stan, of the criminal wars in Afghanistan and Iraq is the number of maimed, sick, and traumatized former United States soldiers, and many of them barely in their 20s, who are going to require medical assistance for the rest of their lives. For political reasons, the scope of the tragedy is barely being reported, despite the impact it's having on a significant layer of young men and women, their families, and the communities.
Well, I certainly agree with you. In fact, those of you who have read the remarks John Murtha, a retired Marine Corps colonel, and he talks about what finally turned him against the war, was talking to the men in Bethesda Naval Hospital at Walter Reed Naval Hospital, young men who had been crippled and maimed in the senseless war. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Arthur Burnclow of the Veterans for Constitutional Law. And, of course, we're talking about the plight of the veterans. And I was just simply commenting that Congressman John Murtha, those of you who haven't read his original speech to Congress, and incidentally, it was never completely reported in the New York Times, and even hard to find on Congressman Murtha's website, although we do have this the complete text of the speech that he gave back. I believe it was in November. November of 2005, but he talked about how, you know, on his weekends he'd go to the Walter Reed Hospital in Bethesda Hospital and talk to these people, and how, you know, these are people crippled for life, and they had a feeling of total frustration, and that they were not, we know that they did not supply them with adequate armor. The government knew that, and they did not armor their vehicles. And of course, Donald Rumsfeld's comment, well, if we go to war with the army we have, Well, why would you send in an inadequately equipped army into an elective war, because we weren't under any attack? And why would you only send in, you know, 160,000 men when we had 695,000 men, simply to chase a few ragtail, you know, people out of Kuwait? Why did we need 695,000 men for that? But now we're supposed to get by with 160,000? Come on now. Why are you trying to do it on the cheap? Why aren't you supplying what they need? And why aren't you, you know, really, of course, trying to build up the Iraqi army so we can pull our men out? And, of course, I don't believe we intend to pull out. I think we want the chaos so that we can justify staying there. But you go ahead, Arthur.
Well, due to improvements in the surgical techniques, the medicine and body armor and transportation, actually only 9% of American casualties in Iraq die from their wounds, compared to 17% who died in Vietnam and 23% during World War II. The official United States death toll since November 2001 stood at 2,513 as of February 7th. 261 deaths in Afghanistan and 2,252 deaths in Iraq. The official wounded number stood at 17,096. These are stunning numbers. 676 in Afghanistan and 16,420 in Iraq. The lower death rate compared with previous wars means that soldiers are surviving after suffering horrifying injuries. As many as 6% of all wounded in Iraq who could not return to duty have required amputations, compared with 3% in earlier conflicts. In Army hospitals alone, more than 330 men have had an arm or leg amputated. 53 suffered multiple amputations. The total figure of amputations is likely to be higher. The Marine Corps, which does not release casualty data, has engaged in some of the bloodiest fighting in Iraq and suffered a considerable proportion of U.S. casualties.
Okay, well, I think, of course, it's such a tragedy. And, of course, you know, the president told us we went into war because we had Saddam Hussein weapons of mass destruction. And then when that didn't turn out well, we went in because, of course, he was associated with Al-Qaeda. And of course, it turned out that, of course, the secular society of Saddam Hussein hated the Al-Qaeda, feared them, didn't want anything to do with them. And so whether we went in because Saddam Hussein was such a terrible guy, but remember, he worked for the CIA back in the 50s, and we helped him all during the 1980s. He was such a terrible guy. Aren't the people who helped him and kept him in power in the 1980s, aren't they culpable? People like, of course, George Herbert Walker Bush, the president's father. So why did we really go into this war? And if there's a question as to why we went into the war, what do you tell these men who've lost an arm or two arms or an arm and a leg or two arms and a leg? Or, you know, pick up the story there.
Well, there's nothing you can tell them. This is why we call it an American tragedy. And features published on October 25th, 2005, and January 31st this year, the New York Times has documented the plight of some of the worst cases of wounded soldiers. Those who have been classified as polytrauma patients. Citing the director of the Veterans Hospital in Tampa, Florida, Dr. Stephen G. Scott, he's one of the good guys. The Times reported at the typical polytrauma case, had head injuries, vision, and hearing loss, nerve damage, multiple bone fractures, unhealed body wounds, infections, and emotional or behavioral problems. Some have even severed limbs or spinal cords. At least 215 soldiers have been treated in four specialist centers dedicated to keeping the most severely wounded alive and rehabilitating them. Several new patients are admitted each week, mainly casualties of roadside bombings in Iraq. Many have major brain damage and have needed to be taught how to speak and walk again, even how to swallow. In a grim indication that the Pentagon has well-advanced plans for future wars, the Department of Veterans Affairs, the VA, plans to construct 21 more specialist centers. One case cited by the Times contained a 29-year-old Marine with profound brain injuries, third-degree burns, and a damaged nervous system. He and his young wife will require hundreds of thousands of dollars of assistance each year to ensure adequate care and ongoing treatment and rehab. Paul Pasquina, a military doctor at Walter Reed Hospital, told the New York Times in October 2005, "Someone who loses one limb is a challenge to get back to a meaningful, functional lifestyle. But someone who loses three limbs on top of other types of soft tissue wounds, fractures, head injuries, spinal cord injury, paralysis, a question mark." Dead question mark.
Well, look, Arthur, I've heard that certainly the regular Army and the Marines, they get adequate medical coverage and disability. But if you are a National Guard person or a reserve person, you have a very, very difficult time getting your treatment and getting your disability. What's the background to that?
Oh, they treat you like a third-class citizen.
In other words, if you are a National Guard and you're called up, you do not get the same treatment or the same privileges that if you are involved in the regular Army or the Marine
Corps. You're supposed to, but it doesn't always happen. It doesn't always happen. You're supposed to. There shouldn't be any preference, whether you're National Guard, whether you're Marine, whatever you are, but it doesn't work that way. This is something we all know. It doesn't work that way.
Well, of course, what about that, of course, would be the military pension. Is that different than the veterans' pension?
Oh, yes. Military pension is for somebody who has served 20 to 30 years. The veterans' pension, technically, it's not a pension. It's compensation.
All right, of course, then the National Guard and Reserves would be entitled to that?
They're entitled to compensation, but they're not entitled to a military pension.
All right, fine. So they can get the compensation. What about medical care? Will they get the same medical care that the people who are regular Army and regular Navy would get?
It depends on where they are and where they're treated. It certainly depends on where they are and where they're treated.
But, I mean, certainly we've heard rumors about the National Guard and the Reserves had not as well treated as the regular Army and regular military people. And perhaps if you're out there in the listening audience and you would know anything about this, give us a call at 1-888-24-Liberty. That's 1-888-24-Liberty or 464-8295. Or if you know anybody who's come back from the from being over there now, what about getting your payment from the Veterans Administration once you get out of the military? Or if you, for instance, had been there and been injured, will you be compensated by the military? Or will you be compensated? In other words, you're injured in battle. You're an enlisted man injured in battle. Will you get a pension from the military, or do you get it from the VA?
Well, you would be getting it. You would be getting it from the Veterans Administration if you're injured in battle. If it's a pension and you've served your time, then you'll get it from the Department of Defense. Now, I'm going to get into these figures here, and then right after I'm going to get into what happens after you get home.
All right, fine.
And complicating the physical rehabilitation are the emotional and the psychological problems provoked by memories of how they were wounded and the extent of their injuries. Dr. Scott told the Times last month, told the story about it, "We expect to follow these patients for the rest of their lives, but I have a great deal of concern about our country's long-term commitment to these individuals. Will the resources be there over time?" That's what Dr. Scott says. He is concerned about the resources.
Well, you know, there's a man named Joseph Stiglitz, who's a Nobel Prize winning economist, and he estimates that the Iraq war, now we're not talking about Iran or Syria or all the other wars that they're planning, but the Iraq war alone is going to cost us $1 trillion and then another $1 trillion to take care of these people afterwards. Where's that money going to come from? And I share this doctor's concern because we don't have the money down the line, especially as this country is the biggest debtor nation in the world. We're going to have a hard time providing economically for these people, and will they just become derelicts?
It's criminal, Dr. Stan. It's really criminal. The concern over the long-term fate of the wounded is compounded when the true dimensions of the casualties that have been suffered by the U.S. military in Afghanistan and Iraq are considered. On top of the official figure of close to 20,000 killed or wounded in action since November of 2001, there are now tens of thousands of soldiers who have been evacuated from Central Asia or the Middle East for non-battle injuries or disease, which we talked about before, and tens of thousands more who have developed psychological problems since their return to the United States. U.S. Transportation Command statistics, cited by journalist Mark Benjamin in a Salon article on December 13th, show that at least another 25,289 troops had been evacuated from Afghanistan and Iraq for injuries that were not sustained in combat. The most recent figures from the United States Army Medical Department, for example, show that March 19, 2003 to November 30, 2005, there had been 21,610 evacuations of Army personnel from Iraq. The figure does include Marine, Navy, or Air Force personnel. The total of 6,087 had been evacuated for non-battle injuries such as back injuries, broken bones, soft tissue wounds, and sight and hearing defects. Another 12,417 had been evacuated under the category disease. The diseases include cases of general surgery, neurological disorders, heart and lung problems, and psychiatric illnesses such as depression, suicidal tendencies, and post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD, and that's very important, which we'll talk about later. The extent of war casualties soars once soldiers return to the United States. The number of Afghanistan and Iraq veterans who have sought health care from the Department of Veterans Affairs, the VA, has already passed 100,000, 100,000, Dr. Stan, or close to one out of every four of the troops who has served in the occupied countries and subsequently left the U.S. military. An unknown number may be related to what was called the Gulf War Syndrome by veterans of the 1991 war. Various ailments that some specialists believe have been caused by exposure to depleted uranium or side effects from anthrax vaccines. By 1999, over 100,000 first Gulf War veterans had sought VA medical treatment for conditions such as leukemia, lung cancer, chronic kidney and liver disorders, respiratory ailments, chronic fatigue, skin spotting, and joint pain. According to VA statistics, cited in December by the Dallas Morning News, some 9,600 Afghanistan and Iraq veterans were being treated for PTSD.
That's post-traumatic stress disease.
Right. Disorder. The number who should be receiving treatment for the disorder is believed to be far higher. An Army study published in the New England Journal of Medicine found that due to the stigma that surrounds psychiatric care, only 25 to 50% of soldiers who develop post-traumatic stress disorder actually do seek assistance. The Defense Department estimates that 18% of Iraq veterans and 11% of Afghanistan veterans will develop PTSD symptoms at some point And this suggests that tens of thousands of ex-service personnel may already be attempting to cope by themselves with highly debilitating disease.
Hold that thought right there.
Self-harm, emotional crisis.
Hold that thought. Severe,
yes.
Okay, this is Dr. Stan. Go right ahead.
Okay. This suggests, what I just mentioned, this suggests that tens of thousands of ex-service personnel may already be attempting to cope by themselves with a highly debilitating disease, which can lead to self-harm, emotional crisis, and in severe cases, suicides or acts of violence. In the Minnesota town of Hibbing, that's H-I-B-B-I-N-G, the local Daily Tribune reported this month on an address by a National Guardsman, Keith Huff, who served a year in Iraq and returned in January 2005. Huff told a February Rotary meeting, "We had a hard time adjusting to your world and we felt alienated. I couldn't tell my wife she was married to a killer and that if I was good at it, I had a hard time re-engaging in the community. I can't explain what it was like to be over there and to come back." An internal army survey, which was cited in Stars and Stripes in December 2005, showed alcohol abuse among returned veterans was 21% 1 year after returning from the war zone. 22% suffered from anger and aggression issues, and 15% intended to break up with their partner. The wave of new victims of American militarism arriving home and needing treatment at VA hospitals and clinics comes at a time of growing need of the VA system by veterans of early wars. An increased numbers of veterans of the Vietnam War and the 1991 Gulf War are registering for VA health care, possibly because failing living standards are making more eligible for the means-tested assistance. They have a means test to see what your income is, and if your income is decent, they will not treat you in the hospital. As well, the surviving veterans of World War II are at an advanced age and average about 1,500 a day dying. It's incredible. The Bush administration's proposed budget for the Department of Veterans Affairs in fiscal year 2007 is $80.6 billion, with some $34.3 billion being requested for health care, an 11% increase. The soaring cost of benefits and medical treatment for the war wounded will more than likely be met by cutbacks to other programs such as Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security. And this is an American tragedy. And I blame this administration's power mad war. And that's all it is. It's a power mad war, and it's a war for profit, and it's a war for oil, and the soldiers and sailors being sacrificed to this war machine is the very last thing on the mind of an uncaring government, Dr. Stan. The very last thing.
All right. Well, I certainly am very, very concerned about the veterans coming back. Now, my understanding is that when you apply for a veterans pension at this time, that there are a couple of 100,000 people doing that at the present time. It takes a long time even to get a case heard. Is that true?
Yes. Sure. It sure does. You put in for a disability for your injury, and put in your papers for it, and sometimes
hold that thought right there, please.
Yep.
Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest this evening is Arthur Bernthal, and we were simply talking about certainly the veterans who are coming back. Now they have a disability, and they have to get their disability from the Veterans Administration. And I have heard that there are up to 300,000 people applying. So, you know, we say, of course we're going to look after our veterans, but they don't have the facilities to look after that large number. A lot of these, of course, are people from previous wars, but a lot of them are people from this war. And so, you know, you've got to apply, and there are 300,000 people ahead of you. How long does it take to get any pension or get any benefits?
Well, there's close to 350. They're behind about 350 cases. There's 350 cases that they are behind on.
350 cases?
350,000 cases.
350,000 cases, right. And so there's a lot of difference.
350,000 cases. And many veterans who are applying for their disabilities, who have bad injuries, are kept waiting a year to a year and a half to even get an answer or a denial. And they keep getting one denial after another and another and another and another, and sometimes it takes you as much as 7 years to get into the Board of Veterans Appeals. And the Board of Veterans Appeals usually does not give you a denial write-off. They will give you a remand, and a remand will send you back to the regional office, and you're going to bounce around the regional office for another year or two before you get back to the Board of Veterans Appeals. Eventually, if you survive that long, you may get up to the Court of Veterans Appeals, which is a total farce. This Court of Veterans Appeals was established in November of 1988, and it was established for the specific reason, they say, of giving veterans judicial review of Veterans Administration decisions. But this judicial review is a farce. It's the narrowest form of judicial review possible. Of 18,000 plus cases heard at the Court of Veterans Appeals, at last count we had a grand total, this was about 6 months ago, of 169 cases. Since then, they don't want to release any statistics, so we don't know how many more in the last 6 months that have been receiving that, but they got some very bad publicity. Now they just don't want to release statistics, and they don't want to release any of the facts.
Well, now, you mentioned that there were a large number of cases. These are the ones that were settled favorably to the veterans. Is this what you're speaking of?
169 cases were settled favorably to the veterans.
And how many of the total number of cases then?
18,169
received something, and the rest of them were turned down by this impartial jury. Now,
turned down or stalled and remanded, and the court, I didn't mention this, the court also can remand you back to the Board of Veterans Appeals. Your case goes back to the Board of Veterans Appeals, and the Board of Veterans Appeals many times, most of the time, will not make a decision, and it'll remand it right back to the regional office where it all got started. And years go by, one by one by one, and the veteran either gives up out of frustration or he expires.
Well, you know, it's sort of like when you get on the telephone now, you want to call the Bell telephone service, and so you get this you know, this voice, and it says you want the message in English or in Spanish, so you pick English, and then they say now dial one of these four, and we're going to give you four options, and none of the options you want, and so they're not one of the ones that when you finally get there that apply to what you have to say. And then of course they'll want to know maybe your telephone number, give us your telephone number, and then you give them the telephone number, and then they get to somebody else, and then they take you on. It takes you 15 minutes. And then suddenly the phone goes dead because you lost your connection. So then you try this over again, and it is the most frustrating thing. You try to get to somebody, you want to find out about your bill, and you can't get to any human being. This is set up specifically just so that you'll spend hours and hours, or they'll put you on the hang, and you'll hear the music, and the music will go on and on and on and on. And after 15 or 20 minutes of hanging on there, why, you finally get frustrated, and you just give it up, and you pay the bill. And ladies and gentlemen, this is exactly what they're doing in the Veterans Administration.
Exactly.
They're simply setting up a situation that they figure that the veteran will eventually give this up. They know how to, of course, get you frustrated. They know how to get you mad. They're playing games with their minds. But these are young men, many of course, who went off idealistically to fight for their country, never realizing, of course, they're going to be betrayed by their country when they came back, because they're people within the Veterans Administration, their job is not to certainly give benefits to the veterans. It's to withhold. Isn't it true that sometimes they get bonuses for withholding benefits?
Oh, yes. They're paid an incentive system If they deny a claim, they can pick up a bonus from the Veterans Administration.
Isn't that nice? Well, it sure makes you feel really proud and patriotic. Ladies and gentlemen, we've got to get back to America. We've got to take care of the men who have fought for our country. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and our guest is Arthur Bernclaw for the Veterans for Constitutional Law. So pick up the story there, Arthur.
You know what you were just talking about with going on the phone and saying, do you want the message in English or another language? I have people visiting me coming in from Europe. I have people coming in from Japan, from Australia, and they laugh at what's going on over here, and they said, don't the people realize what our government is doing to us? They actually laugh at this, and I'm at a loss for words. I'm embarrassed. I see this president meeting with somebody like Putin, and Putin comes from I call Russia a rather primitive country, and when Bush and Putin got together, Putin was like a cosmopolitan man of the world, and I hate to say this about our own president. Next to Putin, Bush was a halfwit. I could not believe what these meetings are. It's embarrassing to me as an American to see a man like Bush running this country. It's an embarrassment. I have some facts here, Dr. Stan, if you don't mind, about Afghanistan.
Go ahead.
Yeah, very few people in this country know anything about Afghanistan. And give me some of the ABCs of Afghanistan so people know a little bit more about what kind of a country it is and what we're doing there. The soldiers and officers were taught the basic facts and history of Afghanistan. Among things they learned, it's slightly smaller in area than the state of Texas. And Afghanistan has 28 million people, and perhaps, you know, when we talk about this, they're going to understand a little bit more about what's going on there. 44% of them are called Pashtuns. That's P-A-S-H-T-U-N-S. They're a fierce people who are themselves often divided and whose first loyalty is to family and tribe. There are also Tajiks, Uzbeks, Hazara, which is a group of Shiite Muslims, widely believed to be descendants of Genghis Khan's hordes, and Nuristanis, recent converts to Islam, formerly known as Kafirs, or unbelievers. And this information comes from James Estrin at the New York Times. When soldiers at Fort Drum are deployed to Afghanistan, they will face what one general calls a very savvy, capable adversary.
Hold that thought. We'll be back in here. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Arthur Bernclaw, and we're talking about really what's going on. At this point, he was just talking about what's going on in Afghanistan. I would point out that Afghanistan, under the Taliban, the wicked Taliban, really wasn't producing very much in the way of heroin. They'd actually cut back on the heroin trade. And once American got in there and freed the people, suddenly, the poppy fields are blooming. Now,
our troops
are there. They could destroy that tomorrow. They could certainly take out the crops by spraying with helicopters. They could burn the fields. And our troops are there to actually protect those fields. Why, if we're really involved in war on drugs, when we occupy the country that's producing 80% of the heroin that's used in Europe, why are we protecting that, and why aren't we trying to stop the heroin trade? Or maybe the war on drugs is as phony as the war in Iraq today. In fact, I would just simply quote recent article in the New York Times. If any of you'd like a copy, we'd get it for you. I mean, we're told, well, what we're trying to do in Iraq is you're just waiting until the Iraqis are ready to defend themselves. Well, there's a Major General Paul Eaton, who's now left the Army. But, you know, after we went in there, and, of course, society was attacked, we'd won the war in a matter of a few weeks, and the Iraqi army meant the units were intact, and they had a stable society. And of course, the president sent over Paul Bremer, who immediately disbanded the Iraqi army, disbanded the Iraqi police force, disbanded the Iraqi civil service, and created chaos. But then, of course, they said, well, now we're going to rebuild the Iraqi army. So Major General Paul Eaton was given that job. And he was, of course, he was given six men. As he said, here's a nation of 25 million. I'm to rebuild an army for a nation of 25 million. I'm given six men. Eventually, they did give him a few other men, but they were never there for more than 3 or 6 months. They needed a cadre to begin to drill the troops, to get them shaped up, but of course, they would not allow them to call back any of the intact Iraqi regular Republican troops that certainly could have done the job. And as Major General Paul Eaton commented, trying to train an army without drill sergeants, without people, you know, who could act to train the troops is like trying to put a tent up without tent poles. And of course, the inference is it can't be done. We're not trying to rebuild the Iraqi army, ladies and gentlemen. They're lying to you. They've created the chaos there to justify our staying there. And I fear, of course, they want us to stay there because they wanted this as a jumping off point for our attack on Iran and Syria and to continue our troop presence in the Middle East. But we can't tell the American people that. We've got to tell them, oh, we're just trying to reorganize the Iraqi army. And as soon as they're able, they're going to be able to take over and everything's going to be fine. It's like Vietnam all over again.
It's baloney, Dr. Stan. It's baloney, and everyone here knows it. Now, what we were talking about before with the drug business, we were talking about Afghanistan and the drug business. The drug business was pretty much under control there. Until we came into Afghanistan, and now it's gone wild. It's out of control. It's totally out of control now. And a new challenge is undertaken by Army Division, the ski troops. The climate is arid over there in Iraq. In Afghanistan, it's arid to semi-arid, with the mountains of the Hindu Kush rising to 16,000 feet. Pashto, that's P-A-S-H-T-O, and Dari, D-A-R-I, which are related to Farsi. The Persian, spoken in Iran, are the principal languages there. The Pashtuns live by a code of honor called Pashtunwali. They need to be hospitable, Mr. Moyer explained on here from the Times. They have the right to revenge. That's the big one over there in Afghanistan. And then he added in a colorful language here that soldiers should avoid angering the Pashtuns. A soldier in the back chimed in, recommending The Kite Runner, the best-selling novel by Khalid Hosseini about the Taliban in Kabul. Then some of the veterans of the Afghan tour spoke up, with one challenging the axiom that it is the village of tribal elder who is the key power broker in that country. Now, that's a mistake we made lots of times, he said. They trot out this old guy, and he's just an idiot. The real leader is the young guy with the slick back hair. A major problem, another added, was the difference in the way they perceive time. Everything takes so much longer than you expected, and you just have to deal with it over there. It's a different concept of time that they have in this world than we have out here in the Western world. On the sprawling base where the Windorf Lake, Ontario, that's up in Camp Drum, Fort Drum, brings blinding snow this time of the year in a base just north of Watertown, that's 95 miles north of Syracuse, there is a Cultural Awareness Learning Center, a prefabricated building behind division headquarters, with classrooms, a lending library of books on Afghanistan, and language laboratories. We've studied this, Dr. Stan. We've studied this very carefully. At a minimum, all the soldiers will carry a card with phonetic approximations in Pashto and Dari of such useful phrases as, drop your weapons, lie on your stomach, and calm down. These are lessons learned, said Chief Warrant Officer Jeff Memgren, an intelligence expert. They're learned the hard way, unfortunately. At the same time, the 10th Division, that's the Mountain Troops, has not neglected its training for warfare. writing more than 30 years ago, Louis Dupré, a leading scholar of Afghanistan, noted that an early name for the area, particularly the tribal regions spanning the Durand Line, could be translated as the land of the unruly, land of rebels, or land of insolence. Not much has changed over the years. Now it's a land weary after more than two decades of war, and there are some signs of compromise and rebuilding, particularly in the cities. It is still uncertain, though, how far the authority of President Karzai's American-backed government extends past his palace walls. We believe it doesn't extend past his palace walls. Complicating matters is the growing problem of illegal narcotics that we mentioned before. Post-Taliban Afghanistan exports 87% of the world's opium, the base ingredient for heroin, some 4,200 metric tons, according to the United Nations. Officers here estimate that 60% of the population now is dependent on the opium trade.
So why didn't the American government shut down the opium trade? If we're really involved in a war on drugs, we could certainly provide other things for them to do. We could give them jobs. We certainly could provide alternative forms of agriculture for them or do anything to have jobs. And the thing is that our government is protecting the drug industry, and you have
exactly.
to ask yourself why. And, you know, this is what the average American can't understand.
We're protecting
the
drug industry there. This is what we're doing. We are protecting this drug industry. Otherwise, we could close it down in a heartbeat.
And of course, it's the same thing is true in South America. But they can't let American people believe that, that we're supposed to believe there's a war on drugs. Well, if you're out there in the listening audience and you have a comment, don't hesitate to call at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. But go ahead, Arthur. Certainly, I think every American should stop and think, look, if we're really involved in a war on drugs, why do we stop this? They give all sorts of explanations. None of them are legitimate.
Exactly.
And the real truth of the matter is that the Central Intelligence Agency has been involved in the drug smuggling, not only in America, but throughout the world for many years. And you say, that couldn't be true. We've got books on it. We've got the book Drugging America, Defrauding America. Let me finish, Arthur,
okay.
Please. We have a four-tape set entitled, Is There Really a War on Drugs? And you'll actually hear Bill Clinton talking about, when asked about the smuggling of drugs at the MENA airport, his remark, and you'll hear his own voice saying, well, that wasn't me, that was the federal government. So pick up the story.
Well, anyone who served in Vietnam can tell you about what went on with the CIA and the drug smuggling, and it's a disgrace. It always has been. Now, there's concern that tactics used by insurgents in Iraq may be migrating to Afghanistan. There have been at least 25 suicide bombings there, which were previously unknown. Since September, they've had 25 suicide bombings, at least. The best place for that migration to take place is on the web, said Colonel Morrison, the intelligence officer glaring suspiciously at his computer screen. I can get on the web and in 2 minutes learn how to build a bomb. That's a fact. Mullah Omar, the one-eyed Taliban leader, issued a statement last month calling America the biggest enemy of Islam and linking rebellion in Afghanistan with the Iraqi insurgency. In Afghanistan, they face the same fate. They will face the same fate very soon with the beginning of the new year. Afghan Mujahideen will intensify their attacks. Their techniques will improve, he said, presumably from somewhere in the Pashtun tribal areas. For Colonel Michael Cross, the division's operational officer, it is that border region where recent rocket strike on the Pakistani side may have killed some ranking Al-Qaeda operatives along with a number of civilians that is crucial to Afghanistan's future. They've got to get control of the border, Colonel Cross said. No doubt that is a challenge we are oriented on. Traditionally, it was a tribal region. Control was not well exercised out there. That's just history, he said. I'm just not saying anything new. Dr. Stan, what are we doing there? Well, we've already won the war. What are we doing there?
Well, I think that we have to understand that we have no intention of leaving. We're there to occupy the Middle East, and in the process of doing that, we're going to inflame the anger and hostility of the Muslim world. And my very real fear, as is a direct result of our policy of creating chaos in Iraq, and you could not do as poor a job as we've done unintentionally. Our militaries wanted more men. Our militaries wanted to rebuild the Iraqi army and been blocked at every turn. And so we don't control anything in Iraq today. They can't even safely drive from the road from the green zone out of the airport and back. In fact, the streets in many parts of Iraq are simply under the control of the insurgents, not of our own military. But what we're doing, I fear, is preparing for a war with Iran and with Syria, and with that will come the anger and hostility uniting the entire Muslim world against America, and then heaven help us here. And why would you do anything that stupid unintentionally? And I believe it's they know exactly what they're doing. They just want the American people to know what the next step is.
Of course. Of course. Dr. Stan, I got a copy of a letter that was just sent to Senator Graham of Florida on the Senate Veterans Affairs Committee by a Sergeant Art Morin. If you don't mind, I'd like to read it. It's a
All
short
right, go,
letter.
Go ahead.
I'll give you a little background. Art Morin, Sergeant Art Morin, is a fully disabled veteran down in South Carolina. He's in Summit in South Carolina. And he was diagnosed as having a brain aneurysm and was being treated by the Veterans Administration Hospital, who was supposed to operate on him and did not do the surgery. They kept stalling and stalling and stalling. And, you know, 1 week passed, another week, another week, another week. He finally said, are you going to operate or not? And he had to end up going over emergency by ambulance to the University of South Carolina hospital, in which an emergency surgery was performed, by the way, by the same one who would have been doing the operation in the Veterans Hospital. But it was performed immediately at the University of South Carolina hospital, which saved his life.
Well, of course, you do not sit on a brain aneurysm. If you have a brain aneurysm, it's bleeding, you go in immediately on an emergency basis.
You bet. That's the way it's supposed to be done.
Right. Go ahead.
And according to this, if you're a disabled veteran and the procedure is not being done in the Veterans Hospital, or for some reason they can't do it or won't do it, and it's a life-saving procedure, you have the right to go to any private hospital that can do this and have it done, and the Veterans Administration is supposed to pick up the bill.
Okay.
Well, this is about 3 years ago, almost 4 years ago. They have not picked up the bill. They have really killed this man's credit. He's got no credit at all, and the VA was supposed to pick up the bill, and they never have. And this letter went to Senator Graham at the Senate Veterans Affairs Committee. Dear Senator Graham, I desire to thank you and your staff for the assistance they rendered my family and I with regards to Dorn Veterans Administration Medical Center. That's the one that did not operate on him, that he had to go to University of South Carolina. However, the assistance or lack thereof was not ample enough to convince them to pay my medical bills at the Medical University South Carolina, which they owe. Additionally, your assistance did nothing to stop the lies fabricated by Brian Heckert, the CEO of Dorn Veterans Administration Medical Center. Senator, you need not trouble yourself with the issue. All is going to be revealed in my book, My Country, Try to Kill Me. The writing will clearly illustrate the racketeering, influencing, and corruption which is taking place in the organization, the Veterans Administration. Additionally, the book will also show how the Senate, Congress, and executive branch has blown off this veteran and many other veterans. A majority of the book will be dedicated to the egregious United States Code Title 38, which separates veterans from the remainder of the citizens in this great nation. Senator, you have a great day. I pray daily to the God of my understanding that those individuals who have betrayed veterans will roast in hell on Judgment Day. Respectfully, Sergeant Art Morin.
Well, Chris, the thing is, how do you get a book like that distributed? Because they will do everything to block its distribution.
Well, you're right about that, but he says if he has to self-publish it, he will. Tyrone Dancy self-published his book. That's Serving Under Adverse Conditions. I believe I sent you a copy of that.
Well, I think the tragedy is, of course, how do you get them out across America? It's very, I mean, if you get it published through the regular publishers, you can get them out. But if you self-publish it, it's a real battle. Occasionally, you will get fairly good, but you may get a 10,000-20,000 distribution. I've self-published several books, and I got 20,000 or 30,000 distribution on that. But it's not like getting it in the major bookstores where you get 200,000, 300,000, 400,000 copies out. So what they've done is they've really taken control of the major publishing houses. They have their people planted in the major distribution centers. I know, for instance, on my book, AIDS, The Unnecessary Epidemic, was in print. Somebody would go in, and there's a place where they keep the ISDN numbers of books in print and keep saying it was out of print. Time and time again that happens. So they have all sorts of little games to play to keep the American people from really knowing what's going on. So I certainly hope that the sergeant will get his book published, and of course you'll get a copy to me. We'll have him on here because
I promise to get a copy to you, Dr. Stan. I promise that.
We need, of course, to get the American people to understand that the Veterans Administration and, of course, their allies at every level of government are betraying the veterans, those brave men who went overseas to fight for freedom, as we were losing freedom here at home. All right, Arthur, go ahead. We've got three minutes to finish the program.
Okay. By the way, Tyrone Dancy, since he's published his book, almost every single day I've had people call me or write me about the book. And Tyrone Dancy, I'll add a footnote to the book that he published. Tyrone Dancy has now gotten his 100% total disability, and we're working now with him to get him all the retroactive money they owe him for 35 years. But he has now gotten his 100% disability. That's a footnote to that. And he's now completing training to be a Veterans Service Officer for his county in Pennsylvania, and he's going to be representing veterans seeking claims from the VA for his county there in Pennsylvania, and he's doing very, very nicely.
Now, how did he get the full 100% disability rating?
Tyrone Dancy was injured in a firefight, and he received no less than 15 wounds in this firefight. And, by all rights, he really shouldn't be here anymore. The man was a shell when he came back from Vietnam. And from the start, they gave him 80% disability. Now, the difference between giving him 80% disability, he got less than $1,100, where he would have gotten over $2,400 for the disability. But they chose to give him 80%, and each and every year, he applied for an upgrade to 100, and they kept turning him down. And I told Tyrone Dancy to start a racketeering influence corruption organization suit, not only against the VA, but against your two senators who blew you off, and your service organizations who represented you, the American Legion and the DAV, and just about everybody else in sight. It's like going fishing and throwing all your lines into the water. And once you start this RICO suit and you apply for your upgrading, as you always do every year, and send them a copy of your brief on the RICO suit, and you're going to be surprised at how fast they're going to pay you. And sure enough, he got his 100%.
Oh, is he able to do any work at all? Is he totally disabled? Or is he...
He's able to do his work. He's able to sit at a desk, but the man was impacted by the war. He has severe PTSD, but he keeps that under wraps, and he seems to have that under control, but his physical limitations are marked there.
All right,
marked physical limitations.
We're out of time, Arthur. Thank you so very much for being with us. Again, get your telephone number out.
Okay, thank you for having me, Dr. Stan. For all those who want to reach me or help us with any donations or have a problem with the VA?
Hold that thought for just a minute. We'll have you put the number out in just a moment. Right?
All right.
All right, fine. Arthur, let's get your telephone number out.
Okay, my number is 631-474-4261, 631-474-4261, and we're Veterans for Constitutional Law Limited. We're located at 112 Jefferson Avenue in Port Jefferson, New York. Port Jefferson, New York, 11777. And if you're having any problems with the VA, we'd sure like to know about it, and we might be able to help you, and there is never any charge for our help.
All right, God bless, and thanks very much.
Thank you, Dr. Stan.
All right, fine. Well, that was Arthur Brent Clough from Veterans for Constitutional Law, and a lot of our veterans are having very, very real problems with the Veterans Administration, and their job is to keep you from getting a rating and to keep you from getting a disability. And they actually get bonuses if they turn you down. What sort of situation is that? Well, ladies and gentlemen, this is the time when I need to remind our listeners that Radio Liberty is primarily listener-supported, and we look to you for help. And we do hope that many of you will give serious consideration to joining the Radio Liberty family of supporters. We are actually on about 60 outlets every single week, trying to get people to understand we're involved in a spiritual battle being fought on a political, ideological, and cultural battlefield. Please go to our website at radioliberty.com. And you can listen to our programs there on the Internet live. You can listen to them archived. You can listen to them on MP3. And then, of course, we hope many of you will want to get my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, the great new DVD we have entitled Secret Mysteries of America's Beginning, which will take you into the secret societies. And yes, ladies and gentlemen, there really are secret societies. What do you think the pyramid cap by the all-seeing eye is doing on the back of your dollar bill, and why doesn't anybody really want to talk about it and tell you the true origin of that occult symbol, and what's an occult symbol doing on the back of the dollar bill? The video, The Secret Mysteries of America's Beginning, my DVD, it's a DVD or a video, it's called The Brotherhood of Darkness, will introduce you to the secret societies. Certainly our pamphlets, the three pamphlets set, the occult hierarchy, this will give you the background to so much of what's going on. And so we do hope that many of you will want to get in touch with my ministry. It's 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. If you'd like to get a free copy of one of our newsletters, why, just give us a call. And our January and December newsletters deal with the background of why are we really in Iraq. Did we go there for oil? Did we go there because Saddam Hussein was a wicked guy? Or did we go there because Saddam Hussein was working with Al-Qaeda and the wicked Osama bin Laden? Did we go there because of weapons of mass destruction? Or was there another reason? And I think you'll be fascinated as you read these letters, and hopefully you want to continue reading the letters. But they're available for free up on the Internet at radioliberty.com. That's www.radioliberty.com. And, of course, we hope that you'll go to our website, read the material that's there, tell other people about our ministry, and explain to them that America is at a crossroad, and that we either have revival in this country and turn back to God, or the freedom that we've enjoyed in the past will be lost forever. For as Thomas Jefferson said so well, God, who gave us life, gave us liberty, but can the liberty of a nation be secure when the conviction has been forgotten that liberty is the gift of God? I tremble for my country when I reflect that God is just, and his justice cannot sleep forever.